From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Congressman Bill Keating blasts President Trump for turning Republicans against a Massachusetts tribe's casino project.
The fact that the president knew the bill number just demonstrates to me that he was getting fed that by his lobbyist. He doesn't know bill numbers.
Also today, the mother of a young man murdered at Harvard in 2009 tells us about her last morning with her son. She was making breakfast when he called from the next room.
And he said, hey, Mom. And I'm like, what do you want? And he's like, I love you. And I'll never forget that sound in his voice.
And a Celtics playoff run with a promising start comes to a devastating end.
I did a bad job as a coach. If your team doesn't find its best fit together, that's on you.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. The Mashpee Wampanoag's billion-dollar casino project in Taunton has hit an unexpected roadblock. All looked clear for a House vote that would confirm the tribe's sovereignty over more than 300 acres of land, including the proposed gaming site. Then President Trump tweeted. He urged Republicans who previously signaled support to vote no, decrying a, quote, special interest casino bill backed by Elizabeth Pocahontas Warren. End quote. Democrats promptly scrapped the vote. Now the bill's backers say the president was unduly influenced by a lobbyist representing Rhode Island casinos, a lobbyist whose wife works in the White House. We spoke earlier with the bill's sponsor, Massachusetts Congressman Bill Keating. I began by asking him what he thinks of the president's claim that the bill is unfair to Native Americans.
I would say this. It's just absolutely untrue. This is a bill really to deal with rectifying injustices over the years to an iconic tribe. That tribe has suffered injustice after injustice over the years, and over that period of time, they've lost all their land. And they were finally recognized in 2017, only to have that recognition pulled by the Trump Interior Department.
So besides claiming that the bill is unfair, the president hinted at another motivation. He said that the bill is sponsored by or backed by Senator Elizabeth Warren. She's actually not on this House bill, but she did sponsor a similar bill in the Senate last year.
So the president's tweet was, again, not factual.
But about that, though, I mean, is it a political play? Obviously, Senator Warren is a candidate to oppose him in 2020. Is he just trying to deny her a political victory here, Congressman, or something else?
The president... His actions were political. You know, he signed an identical bill last year. He had no objections last week when the House passed an identical bill for a California Republican. The reason we're left with that he interceded here to try and affect the result is clearly because the head of the conservative PAC, CPAC, a huge supporter and a far right-wing group, in our country.
This is Matthew Schlapp you're talking about.
Yes, and he also has the ability to, in his contract, take on lobbying interests, which is kind of a conflict if you think about it. But one of those lobbying interests was the casinos in Rhode Island. If you look at what happened, he put out a tweet just minutes before the president with great similarity. The president just followed suit. Frankly, and I don't mean it doesn't surprise your listeners, the fact that the president knew the bill number just demonstrates to me that he was getting fed that by his lobbyist. He doesn't know bill numbers.
Well, just to fill in a little bit more detail on the lobbying that you were talking about, so Matthew Schlapp, who runs CPAC, is lobbying for the Twin River Management Group that you mentioned. So those are the Twin River Casino in Rhode Island. They're opposed to this project in Taunton, perhaps because they see some competition. And it's also worth mentioning.
The puzzling thing with that is that the Commonwealth of Massachusetts has already acted, and they've granted a casino license for that region. So there will be a casino in that region one way or the other. So I'm really puzzled by the actions of the state of Rhode Island and puzzled by the action of those casino owners that hired one of Trump's friends to be their lobbyist, because it's not going to really effectuate the result. What's going to happen is it'll go to some other Las Vegas-based interest.
So this is a billion-dollar casino project by the Mashpee Wampanoag. Congressman, do you see any long-term effect on that? Because this bill was being fast-tracked. It was expected to be able to get the two-thirds majority that it would need, so it was going to get some Republican support. Even without that, if the president comes out against it, do you think that you can pass it relatively quickly with a simple majority with just Democrats supporting?
I do. We have a core of Republican support. It's a bipartisan bill. The sponsorship is by many of the most respected members on the Republican side of the aisle, people that are in positions of leadership as well as people that have a Native American history of working with tribes across the country. So that core has remained steadfast. We'll move forward and be able to get that majority perhaps in the next week.
I think one other factor to consider is that the president, because of his previous business career, which included casinos, does have some experience. And this isn't the first time that he's gone after tribal casinos. In fact, in 1993, he was testifying before a House committee. He claimed at the time that the mafia was running rampant in the Native American gaming casinos, and he complained the tribes didn't have to pay the same taxes that he did on his casino properties. Let's just listen to a bit of that hearing.
If you look at some of the reservations that you've approved, you, sir, in your great wisdom have approved, I will tell you right now, they don't look like Indians to me, and they don't look like the Indians. Now, maybe we say politically correct or not politically correct. They don't look like Indians to me, and they don't look like Indians to Indians, and a lot of people are laughing at it, and you're telling how tough it is, how rough it is to get approved. Well, you go up to Connecticut, and you look. Now, they don't look like Indians to me, sir.
So what do you think about that, Congressman? I mean, that sounds a lot like the campaign rhetoric we hear from the president these days.
Well, there's a lot of irony there. He's talking about how he pays taxes. We now found out with the disclosure from the New York Times that, indeed, Donald Trump was paying no taxes. And the fact is that the Native Americans do pay taxes and do pay funds. So there is not a competitive advantage that way. So he's wrong on those counts. And unfortunately, by saying things about categorizing people by how they look, unfortunately, is another strain of, frankly, the tweet that had racist parts to it as well that he put out. So this is it's sad. It's disappointing. And unfortunately, not surprising.
Congressman, you mentioned earlier that this legislation is sort of necessitated by a decision that the president's Department of the Interior made. And it's worth mentioning that Matthew Schlapp has responded, saying that legislation conflicts with federal district court and Department of Interior decisions, as well as precedents set by the U.S. Supreme Court. So you're using the same facts there, Congressman, but interpreting them differently. He's saying that lawmakers should back down here because of those precedents.
Donald Trump signed similar legislation a year ago. He signed it himself with a Virginia tribe. So there's where the lack of consistency is. He didn't raise his voice. He didn't contact the House last week when an identical bill for a California tribe sponsored by a Republican went through. Not a whimper, not a sound, and not a tweet. So it's pretty clear where this is coming from, and he can try to disguise it, cloaking it in a racist tweet as a diversion. His lobbyists can try and disguise it. But it's pretty obvious and unfortunate, but it's something, fortunately, with a new House and a new majority and strong bipartisan support across the aisle and a core support that will stick with us, and stick, more importantly, with the Mashpee tribe. That's going to occur next week, I believe, and then we'll be successful. And in the end analysis, the House of Representatives will be on the right side of history.
That's Congressman Bill Keating. He represents the 9th District of Massachusetts. Congressman, thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. 10 years ago this month, 21-year-old Justin Cosby was shot and killed in a Harvard residence hall. The burst of violence on an Ivy League campus became national news. Ultimately, a jury found that a young man named Jabri Copney murdered Cosby after attempting to rob him of the marijuana he was trying to sell. Copney is serving a life sentence. Two other men pleaded guilty to lesser charges, and Copney's girlfriend, Brittany Smith, confessed to hiding the gun and received a 3-year sentence. While the events happened at Harvard, only Smith was a Harvard student. Justin Cosby's mother, Denise Cosby, has self-published a book about her son and what it meant for her to lose him. It's called Murder at Harvard's Kirkland House, A Mother's Worst Nightmare. We asked her to come speak with us about her son and her experience. Denise Cosby, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Could you begin just by telling us a little bit about your son, Justin? What was he like? How do you remember him?
My son was a very vibrant, happy-go-lucky young man. He loved video games. He loved basketball. He loved cars, and he loved girls. You know, he was the typical 21-year-old young man.
And take us back to May 18th of 2009, if you would. What was that day like for you?
That day started out just as every other day. I remember getting up that morning, greeting my son in the hallway. And afterwards, I went to the kitchen. I started to decide what I was going to have for breakfast that day. And I heard a voice call out to me from my son. And it was about 10:30 in the morning, and he was sitting in the computer room. And he said, hey, Mom. And I'm like, what do you want? And he's like, I love you. And I'll never forget that sound in his voice. And it wasn't unusual for him to say that to me because he was a known mama's boy. But I walked into the room where he was sitting that day. And I remember standing in the door, and I looked at him, and I'm, are you sure you love me? And he looked at me and got this big old Kool-Aid smile on his face and said, of course I love you. Get out of here. You know? So it was a typical day until later on that day. I decided to go out. I had been in the house all day, and a news bulletin flashed across my TV set. It stated that a young man had been shot down on the grounds of Harvard University. I was, you know, I was so thrown by it because it was so unusual. And I hear bulletins all the time, but for some reason or another, this one really got to me. And I couldn't get it out of my mind. They said that the young man, it was not a Harvard student, they didn't think, but they didn't know the situation at the time. So I thought my son was in his room, which was right next to my room. He had been home pretty much all day. And I decided I'll go out for a while, and I couldn't get it off my mind. And when I got to my friend's house, I told her about it. And then about an hour later, I got a call from his girlfriend, which asked me had I heard from him, and I thought that was unusual. But I decided to call him on his phone, and it went straight to his voicemail. I never did get a response, and he usually calls me right back, even if he doesn't answer immediately when I call. Never did get a call back. So I proceeded to go home. I'm driving down the winding Jamaica Way, and I get a call from one of his friends. And he's like, Denise, something's happened to Justin, and they say you need to get to the hospital right away. So I thought maybe my son had been involved in a car accident. That's the only thing I could even think about in my mind. And once I got there and met the police officers, and they told me about a shooting at Harvard University, it was just like, you know, having that flashback of the news bulletin go through my mind.
You suddenly put the two together.
And put the two together. And it was just an unbelievable time.
And so then, you know, we hear folks who go through these awful experiences describe grief sometimes hitting them all at once or sometimes coming more slowly in waves. How did the grief come for you?
I would say it not only, it did hit me at once, but it took a while for me to really digest what was going on. It was not only the impact of realizing I just lost my son, but everything that surrounded it. You know, the murder, the location of the murder, the media, speculations. It was really, really bizarre. I thought I was having an out-of-body experience looking at a movie or something because this was not my life. And it's still something that I am struggling with today.
I know that in the aftermath of your son's death, you've become a real advocate against gun violence. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience for you?
After my son was killed, I met a lot of other mothers and fathers who lost children to murder. The relationship that I had with my son, as I said previously, was very close, and I thought no mother or father would have that close of a relationship. But hearing the stories of other parents who have lost children, it made me realize that this is a universal thing. It's a universal loss amongst parents who lose children to murder. And it is the hurt and the pain is something that cannot even be measured. So it is my voice. My son lost his voice, and I've decided to be his voice. And I am definitely supporting others and trying to empower them to tell their story, because when a murder occurs, you're so confused, you're hearing so much, you don't even know what, you know, all of a sudden, who was this person? You know, you lose sight on that. But when you're writing your story and you go back and you educate yourself and you research and you have time to reflect, then you have time to build that person, to bring that person's worth back to the life that they had when they were here on Earth with you.
You know, one other thing I'm wondering about the gun violence, though, is I know that you wrote in your book about considering buying a firearm yourself later. And I think this is a question that a lot of people wrestle with, right? After episodes of gun violence, how best to proceed, how best to protect ourselves? Is it to have fewer guns in circulation? Is it to arm yourself so that you can be a counterweight if someone does show up with a gun? How are you thinking about that question these days?
You know, I thought about that question, of course, immediately after my son's death because of the anger and the pain. But I also think about how I would feel if I were to kill someone or if I were to injure someone.
By accident or even in a defensive situation?
By accident or even in a defensive situation. You have to live with that in your, you know, I don't want to live with the fact that I killed someone. And I've always thought that the only way that I would even consider that would be if someone was to harm my child or my parents. And in this case, it was my child. So, yes, I did consider that. Now, I haven't brought a firearm, but I would not say I won't consider.
Mrs. Cosby, how do you think that race and class played into the way that your case unfolded, your son's case unfolded?
Because of the fact that Justin was a black kid on the elite Harvard campus. Speculations went out across the media lines. But we lived in that neighborhood all of Justin's life. I can look at Harvard right from my bedroom window. I see the Harvard campus that close. But because it was a black child on this Ivy League campus, it was, you know, he's a drug dealer, he's a thug, he's a neighborhood this, you know. And that was before the detectives had a chance to question other people that knew Justin about his character. So that was something that I, you know, when you're talking about some of the other school shootings that have happened amongst, you know, well, it was white schools or whatever, I think it's looked at a little differently.
I think one of the things that stands out to listeners 10 years after the fact is that we're now living in a state where there is a legal avenue to buy marijuana. We don't have very many pot shops open, but we do have some. And so I'm wondering how you think about that, you know, the fact that we do have a way now, if you want to buy marijuana, to do so above board. Could that reduce the need for sort of underground purchases like this that can go so violently wrong?
I definitely think so. People don't normally get killed for pot purchases. And I think that if that was something that was legal at the time, I do think it would have probably minimized or eliminated this situation.
We're speaking with Denise Cosby about her new book, Murder at Harvard's Kirkland House, which chronicles her experience after her son Justin was shot on the Harvard campus in 2009. Mrs. Cosby, the man convicted of shooting your son, Jabri Copney, will serve life in prison. Do you feel like justice was served in the case?
I do feel like he deserved to serve, to serve life in prison. It's very unfortunate that two lives were lost. There were five lives that were actually impacted very badly in this case. You have the shooter, Jabri Copney. He went to prison. I think he was 20, 21 years old for life without no chances of parole. And then you have someone else who served 18 to 20 years, and another person who was just released just before Christmas that was serving 9 to 12 years. And then there were two young ladies that lost the opportunity to receive a degree from Harvard just a couple of weeks before graduation. So all of these lives have been impacted. I wish it had never happened. And then I don't have to think about whether justice was served. There will never be any justice without my son being here again. But again, it's unfortunate because we have all of these families and all of these lives were impacted.
I have to say that what you're telling us is pretty remarkable, because it sounds like, despite the incredible pain inflicted on you and your family, you have, I don't know, a degree of sympathy for the other families. Are you thinking about their mothers in a way? What are you thinking about?
I think about all mothers, and I think about all families. Nobody wants to lose their children to murder, or nobody wants to be the one to say their children murdered. We have to do better.
Have you had any contact over the years with the families on the other side?
No, and I really don't want to.
You know, one of the things I've been thinking about, Mrs. Cosby, reading your book, is that your son Justin and I were born 3 months apart.
Really?
Yeah. And so I've been thinking about the sort of milestones in my own life since that time period that my mother got to experience, you know, a wedding, grandchildren.
Right.
These must be the things that you think about all the time.
All the time. All the time. I would never have the opportunity with my son. And that's crushing every day still. When I look at his picture, you know, every day I think about that. When I see his friends that still come to visit me, and he had a strong set of friends, and I've watched them grow, and some of them have become fathers now, and I see them, and they come to see me, and they bring their children in. I'm always looking to see, you know, Justin's the only one missing. I wonder what he would have done, you know, if he was still here, and I'm sure I would have had a grandchild, you know, but I do miss that.
That's Denise Cosby. Her son was killed on Harvard's campus in 2009, and she writes about it in her new book, Murder at Harvard's Kirkland House, A Mother's Worst Nightmare. Denise, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. We're going to finish with sports today because there is so much going on. The Red Sox are at the White House right now. Well, at least some of them are. The Bruins are dropping the puck tonight in Game 1 of the NHL's Eastern Conference Finals. And the Celtics are dropping out of the NBA playoffs. Joining us now to talk about it all is WBUR Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer. Shira, welcome back.
Thanks for having me again.
Also with us is WBUR and NPR sports commentator and former host of Only a Game, Bill Littlefield. Hey there, Bill.
Hey, how's it going?
Very well. But let's get the bad news out of the way here first, Shira.
So not well for some teams.
Not well for the Celtics. They lost 116-91 in Game 5 of their playoff series with the Milwaukee Bucks, which ends their season. I got to say, Shira, it was kind of tough to watch. I thought there was a sequence at the end of the first half that kind of put the nail in the coffin. You know, they get this awful shot by Gordon Hayward. The Bucks come right back. They nail a three. Brad Stevens loses his mind. Technical foul. I mean, it was like the whole season encapsulated in one awful moment.
You have that sequence at the end of the first half. I have a sequence that I remember at the end of the third quarter. There was about a minute left. And, you know, it was a Milwaukee Bucks offensive possession. And they just kept getting offensive rebound after offensive rebound. around and, you know, second, third, fourth chances at making a shot, making a basket. And, you know, what you could see in that particular sequence was the Bucks were clearly a team that wanted it more. They were hustling for it. They were energized. And the Celtics didn't look like a team with the with their season on the line. And they just simply looked like, you know, they were already done.
The only thing I would object to in your characterization is I don't think you can encapsulate this season in any series of moments because the whole season has been so unpredictable. There were people at the beginning of the season who said this is a great team. And if you just look at the elements of the team and Coach Stevens' history, it looked like they would be a great team.
It was
and
his
some
best roster,
nights,
right?
Yeah. Some nights they looked like a great team, and
some nights, start of the playoffs, they look. I mean, come on, you know,
they
the sweep of the Indiana Pacers,
right,
they
but,
look fantastic.
But throughout the year, they were bouncing between looking like a powerhouse and looking like a bunch of guys who just met each other and had never played basketball together. And that was the strangest thing about the season for me.
I never really started, though, to get that powerhouse feel during the season because it was so up and down. I never thought, you know, wow, this is a team that's going to get it all together. It really often felt like there was no chemistry, that this was a bunch of individuals out there. That Kyrie, you know, was sort of like, do I want to be here? Do I not? Want to be here? What, you know, do I like the young guys on the team? Do I not like the young guys on the team? Should I be finger pointing? Should I be how can I be a better leader? I mean, they never seem to gel or get comfortable with them. And I'm not saying that one sequence symbolizes the series or the team, but you know, there were signs all along, sort of in the cracks in the facade were always evident, and you could see that whether it was at the end of the first half last night, or you know, that game in Orlando. I think it was in January where you know, Kyrie was sort of finger pointing at his younger teammates afterwards. There were always these moments where just when you thought this team was perhaps on the cusp of turning it around, they reverted and took a couple steps back.
I'd say that's an accurate characterization as long as you include both the extremes.
Yes. And this was a season of extremes, and I think it's going to be an off season of extremes as well with, you know, the moves that this team may or may not make. I mean, first, obviously, when we talk about the offseason, we talk about Kyrie Irving. Will he stay or will he go? This was a guy who, let's not forget, season ticket holders, he told them in October, I'm here if you'll have me. And then,
There's an awful lot of people that don't want him the game the other night. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and it's, you know, I think this leaves a bad taste in your mouth going out this way to the Milwaukee Bucks. And, you know, does he want to be here or will we see him in L.A. with LeBron again?
Oh, boy. Just imagine that. Well, let's move on to a team that's doing a lot better, which is our Boston Bruins. They are at home in the Eastern Conference Finals tonight. They'll be playing the former Hartford Whalers, now the Carolina Hurricanes.
Can we have some brass bonanza,
yeah,
please?
Yeah, do you want a little bit? I know, Shira, there's a flashback right there.
Yes.
On the ice, how do these two teams stack up against each other?
I mean, it's going to be a tough, hard-fought series. I think once you get to the Eastern Conference Final in the NHL playoffs, it really can be anyone's game, anyone's series. What I do like about the Bruins' chances, first of all, they were the number two seed in the East, and the Hurricanes are the wild card team, sort of the Cinderella story a bit. And what I do like about the Bruins is, one, they seem to have an edge right now. It kind of looks just like you're there.
His name is Rask.
And that was my next thing. My next thing was their goalie, Tuukka Rask, which was, you know, he is playing absolutely unbelievable. Shutout against the Columbus Blue Jackets in the series finale there. So he is the guy who can potentially carry them to the Stanley Cup final.
And Bill, we know that was the key to winning in 2011, was
a
hot
absolutely.
Goalie.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think in sports, there are a great many cliches, and some of them are absolutely accurate. And I think Shira will agree with me that perhaps the most accurate of all is the hot goalie, especially when you get to the playoffs.
Yeah, hot goalie. And I love this phrase in hockey, puck luck. I mean, you know, I think a hot goalie and some puck luck. And let's not forget in that series finale against the Blue Jackets, how many pucks were, you know, hit against the, you know, Columbus Blue Jacket shots were hit against the crossbar, you know, of the net. And it was just, you know, you're like, Okay.
But I would
some
argue
puck luck
those,
and some rats.
I think those are somewhat related, though, right?
Yes.
Because when you got a really hot goalie, you got a team that's thinking, I really got to pick the corners.
And they're
and
forcing
up,
it a little bit.
And
yeah.
Well, insofar as when the puck is on your stick and the goal is there, you're thinking. I think mostly what you're doing is relying on the fact that you've taken 12,000 shots over the course of your career and you're just trying to put it in the net.
Yeah. One interesting thing to watch for in tonight's game, the Bruins will be without Charlie McAvoy. He is suspended for one game because of the illegal check to the head in the last game against the Blue Jackets. So we're going to see how they adjust there. Just something to watch in addition to Rask.
Yeah, and of course they'll be playing their former defenseman of the future in Dougie Hamilton as well. So that'll be interesting to see in the absence of McAvoy whether the Bruins feel like, oh, we're missing old Dougie. Bill, before we go, I do want to talk a little bit
about
Red
Sox. Such a
hockey
name,
here.
Dougie.
Very good hockey name. On the Red Sox, though, Bill, you know, some of them are at the White House, some of them aren't. There's been a lot of attention on this, mm-hmm. partly because there's a very clear dividing line between who's going and who's not. It's mostly the men of color who are deciding not to go, and a lot of white players are saying that they will go. And manager Alex Cora, who is Puerto Rican, who has said that he is not going, talked about whether he sees a divide in his clubhouse yesterday when he was on WEEI's Ordway, Merlone, and Fourier. Here's what he said.
People are talking about what's going to happen in the clubhouse and it's going to be divided or whatever. That's not the case. That's not the case. We're in a good place.
So you buy that, Bill? I mean, he's sort of putting a shine on it. And the team is playing really well. They pulled up to 500 yesterday with another win.
Right. They've won 8 of their last 10, and that's certainly better than they had done previously. It took them 8 out of 10 to get to 500, which is a little discouraging.
It's only May.
I certainly buy what Cora is saying, and the team better be able to transcend whatever differences there may be about whether they should have gone to the White House en masse or not, because this is not a divide which is peculiar to the Boston Red Sox. This is a divide that is characteristic of the entire country, and we better be able to find a way to work together collectively throughout the nation, not only in the Red Sox clubhouse. So, hey, I hope they go on and win 8 of their next 10 and then 8 more out of their next 10 and demonstrate that they can work together despite the fact that some of them were quite within their rights to do it, decided not to allow Donald Trump to bask in their glory.
Shira, is the chemistry in a baseball clubhouse kind of overrated anyway, though? Because, I mean, of the four major sports, it's probably the most individual. You're sort of one-on-one with the pitcher. It's not a team flow like basketball. But and I see some skepticism.
Yeah, I was going to say, it may not be as important. For instance, we saw with the Celtics what poor chemistry can do to a team throughout a season. It may not be as important in baseball, but I still think it's pretty crucial. You want to be in a clubhouse where you're pulling for the guy who's in the locker next to you. I think it's a pretty important thing to have team unity and to have everybody on the same page. And I think, you know, managers work very hard to establish that. I'm not exactly buying, by the way, what Cora is saying. I just think the divide is so clear among, you know, the players of color and then the white players that it's hard to believe that there isn't something going on. Maybe it's small, but a little something going on behind the scenes. But give him credit for pulling a very typical thing from, you know, the sports playbook, the sports motivation playbook, which is the us against them, and using this and saying, all you guys, all you media guys are crushing us, you know, because we're a divided team. We're not. We're going to show you. We're going to win. You know, we're going to show you that we're not the team you think we are, that we're really a united team. So it's a very savvy move from a savvy manager.
All right, so Bill, in the moments we've got left, the notion of a Boston slam is over. We're not going to get all four because of the Celtics. But how do you like the chances of our teams that are still active right now, the Sox and Bruins we were just talking
I'm
about?
I'm siding with Shira as far as the Bruins are concerned. I think they do have the combination of the hot goalie, and I hope the luck holds out. But they are playing in the way that makes them think they can win it all.
Yeah,
and
that
that's
edge
a
that
very
I was
important quality.
Before we go, as I mentioned, the Sox are at the White House ceremony going on right now. So here's President Trump just a moment ago talking about pitcher Chris Sale.
In the dugout, your starting pitcher, Chris, decided to give the team a little pep talk. Are you an emotional guy? Pretty much, huh? Because I heard it was a hell of a pep talk. Give us a little pep talk every once in a while.
And Sale finally pitching well again. He struck out, I think, 14 last night.
Yeah,
looked really,
he
really
went
good.
Eight innings, right?
Really, so, really good.
Yeah.
That's WBUR sports and society reporter Shira Springer. Thanks as always for your time.
Thanks for having me.
And WBUR and NPR sports commentator and the former host of Only a Game, Bill Littlefield. Bill, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for the opportunity.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.